Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June the 11th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speakers are David Messenbring and Maria Jimenez, who will be speaking to us on the subject, Doing More Ministry with Less Money. Let's listen in.
My name is David Messenbring. And the title of this session is Doing More Ministry with Less Money. And I want to begin by just surveying your expectations. Not necessarily everybody, but give me an idea why you came, what you're expecting from this session.
Well, we're from a downtown church that's kind of a shrinking population in the church, and maybe get some ideas that we can take back.
Good. Anybody else?
Well, I thought you would talk about doing your ministry, about your ministry, which I'm very interested in.
Some of that will come in as an example. Yep. Others?
Sounds better than the other ones.
lesser of two evils. I like you. You're honest. The maybe as an introduction, I can say that the...
Where is the other one? I'm sorry, I got the...
Oh, you're looking for it. The burning question that moves me to offer this session is why with so many unmet needs in our community and in fact around the world, you'll see that this session is going to have a little international dimension to it, as all of my sessions do. Why are there so many unmet ministry needs when there are so many people of such creative and ample resources who've been baptized to discipleship? And I think the reason is, I fear that the reason is because we're deluded by the impression that you need money to make ministry happen. And over and over again, people say, well, if only we had money, then we could run a homeless shelter, and we could do a feeding scheme, and we could do all these other wonderful ideas about ministry. The reason I'm anxious to do this session is because I worked as a religious grant maker in a couple of different ways for a period of about 4 years. Well, maybe longer, depends on how you define it. Most of that time I worked for Trinity Church Wall Street, which if any of you have ever walked around lower Manhattan, right at the head of Wall Street, there's that very old church with the pretty little graveyard around it that stands in the middle of all these skyscrapers. And that church has an annual income, or did at the time I worked for them, about $30 million, which they get from commercial real estate. In 1698, Queen Anne gave them a land grant, which was a huge chunk of Manhattan, and they have kept just a tiny portion of that land, but it's all in commercial real estate in New York, and they generate this fabulous income for the parish. And with some of their money, established a grants program that I worked in. And I had responsibility for two grant programs, about $1 million a year. I was supposed to come up with grant recommendations to a board of directors for funding to projects to strengthen the church in Africa. And then another $250,000 a year was set aside when the parish divested itself of investments in companies doing business in South Africa. That was a very controversial thing to do on Wall Street, as you can imagine. And so they simultaneously set up a fund to invest in the church's role to overcome apartheid. So $250,000 a year worth of grants to South African churches to help overcome the apartheid system in South Africa, and another $1 million a year to strengthen the role of the indigenous African church. And from that experience, I've learned some things about the secret, mysterious world of philanthropy that I'm excited about, and I think more people should know, because it's, as you'll see this evening, has dramatically affected the way the way I do ministry, and with some good result. It might be worth just mentioning for a moment something about how philanthropies work. And we'll focus on religious philanthropies, although there are others that are basically the same. Now, I distinguish between two kinds of philanthropies. There are rich people who seek a tax shelter and set up a foundation in order to cut their taxes, and then they're required by law, by the Internal Revenue Service, to give a certain amount of their assets away every year. Or it might not be of the total assets, but a certain amount at least of the interest on their principal. And a lot of money gets given away in this country by people who basically have set up a foundation just to avoid the tax man. And more often than not, in my cynical opinion, that money gets donated because somebody knows the chairman of the foundation and has a 501c3 tax-exempt program that they can get money for. I'm not talking about that wing of philanthropy tonight. I'm talking about the Ford Foundations, the Pew Charitable Trusts, the Kellogg Foundations, and the Trinity Grants Program that I work for. Agencies that try and be a little bit more disciplined and systematic about what they give money for and how they do it. And those type, the good philanthropists, in my opinion, do so first and foremost by limiting their vision very carefully. They, for example, at the African grants, that $1 million a year that I worked with, said that we were going to fund four types of projects. Theological education in Africa, but not residential seminaries, a different type of theological education that we felt strongly held more promise for Africa, something called TEE, Theological Education by Extension, which we don't have to talk about tonight, but a very specific type of theological education. We were going to fund those type of projects. We wanted to fund income-generating programs for churches that would fulfill rural development needs. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those in a few minutes. We said in the healthcare field, we would fund programs of primary healthcare and women's health. Women and children, basically, were churches, not the hospitals, that took care of people when they got very sick, but the outreach health promotion programs that would try and keep people well. And then fourthly, it's been a while since I worked for them. Rural development, primary health care, TEE, and a fourth one. Doesn't matter. The point is that we narrowed our focus. And the reason that grant makers do that, there are two reasons they do that. One, they know the limits of their resources. $1 million a year sounds like a lot, but Africa's a big place, and the African church has a lot of needs. And $1 million just spread helter-skelter isn't going to make any kind of an impact. But if you focus in a couple of areas, you can hope to have more impact there. The Pew Foundation, which I've looked at recently and actually photocopied and brought along some information, they spend in their religion program in 1995, it looks like about $11 million they gave away. But the narrow focus of how they give that $11 is remarkable. They have three foci, one on religious scholarship, where they're basically trying to invest in early career intellectuals here in the United States and abroad who want to study religion. They pick out what they think are the best and brightest of these people and support their research as a way of contributing to the development of religious scholarship. Secondly, they fund community ministry, especially in the Philadelphia area, and especially in trying to strengthen the role of the Hispanic churches in the United States. Now, when you think about it, that's pretty narrow focusing. You know, but by doing that, they can hope to have more of an impact in the field of Hispanic ministry. And the second thing is, besides impact, they learn more. When you're focusing your grants in a given area, you can hope by working carefully with your grantees and watching what happens to some of the cutting-edge new ideas that you fund, see what works and what doesn't work. You try, if you're a progressive philanthropist, you try and learn from your grant-making enterprise in such a way that you actually accumulate a body of knowledge that helps you 10 years from now get even smarter about what you want to do. The third area that they're working in is cross-cultural Christian partnership. And I was very interested in what I read about what they've learned and what they're doing. They're very concerned that although Christians outside of Western Europe and North America are now by far the majority of world Christianity. I hope that's not news to you. Maybe it is. Maybe you haven't heard that before. But we in North America and Western Europe are now by far the minority part of the Christian community. The baptized, those with whom we share a fellowship of baptism, are, in a global sense, most of them are in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. No longer is Christianity, by its numbers, a religion of Europe and the United States, or North America. But the overwhelming perception of Christianity is still that it's a religion of the Western world, of Western Europe and North America. And the Pew Foundation has decided that this is a problem for Christianity, that the world tends to look at the non-Western Christians, the Christians of Africa and Latin America, as simply the residue of Western imperialism, the Western colonial outreach, which took religion with it. You know, the missionaries who accompanied British colonialism or French colonialism or Portuguese colonialism. The overwhelming view of global Christianity is that it's outside of the West, it's simply an extension of Western imperialism. And that, if you've had any contact with African Christianity, for example, you know is not the case. There are plenty of African Christians who mimic Christianity as practiced in North America, but there are plenty who have got a pretty creative development. The Spirit has worked creatively in their midst in a way that isn't necessarily the same as how we practice or what we think of Christianity to be. So here's the Pew Foundation with $11 million a year focusing in a couple of narrow areas, and so closely focused on this global Christianity idea, for example, that they announced this year they were not even going to continue taking projects, taking funding proposals that would be aimed at helping North American churches understand their global mission better. They were going to just focus on the research and academic side of it. They felt that there was such a problem with how people understood Christianity outside of the Western world that they needed to work on that. And they made, for example, last year a huge grant to the University of Edinburgh to work with five universities in Africa to develop research, a body of research and knowledge that would better bring to light developments in African theology, African Christian theology. All right, enough said about how the foundation communities target their money. They target their money in order to have more of an impact and in order to really get more involved with what they're doing, and in that field, in that small, tiny field, really become an expert. And I mention that because I think that those of us who are involved in less grandiose schemes of ministry, like your downtown church, for example, which is very focused, presumably, on its local community, we can learn from how the big, sophisticated foundations do it. We can learn to pick our projects carefully, to do a good job of what we do, have a big impact in a few areas, rather than scatter our funds loosely with not much impact in a lot of areas. Okay, now I'm going to shift gears a little bit and start talking more about the community ministries that we want to be involved with. And the first thing, the first point I've learned to distinguish between is the difference between operating funds and capital funds. When I was is curious, when the work I did for the Trinity Grants Program, we said flat out that we were not interested in capital grants, in operating grants. We would only do capital, it was only startup. It was even more narrow than that. And we would do some operating funds, but only on a startup basis. And that's not unusual for a foundation to say. We only want to concern ourselves with starting a project up. We don't want to be having to fund it over and over, year after year after year. That's very frustrating from the perspective of a community group that wants to set up a project. Much easier to get money to get that project started than it is to sustain it. And what happens is you find a lot of people who are raising the money to start a program, and then after 2 or 3 years when that grant dries up, you either drop it and start a new program, or you somehow try and
make it sound
like you're starting it up again. Now, the reason I mention this is that I knew when I was reviewing proposals that there's a great tendency for those who want money to chase the whims of the funders and to actually structure your programs according to what the funders want rather than what the people you want to serve need. And that is a very crucial distinction, and why in the ministry that I started work with 5 years ago, which at that point the doors were open, but it was a pretty small, struggling, almost non-existent organization. When I went to work with them, the first thing I said was, we cannot become dependent on foundations for our operating funds. That would be a big mistake. Capital money is a different story. Now, I didn't really define the term, so let me back up for a moment. By operating funds, I mean your salaries, your annual budget. Right now, for Seafarers House, which I work for, we have an annual budget. This year, it's about $1 million. And then, in addition to that, when we put up a building, for example, or we buy new equipment. I hope while I'm on vacation, they're putting up an awning because it rains tremendously in the summers in Florida, and people come to us in a shuttle bus and just going the 15 feet from the bus to the doorway, they get soaked and bring all the water inside. So we're trying to put up an awning. That's a capital improvement to our building. It's different, and I distinguish between those kind of funds from the operating money. Your church building requires capital money to improve. You put in a new air conditioning system, that's a capital improvement. The salary you pay your pastor or your feeding program coordinator, those are operating monies. And I think that it's very dangerous to become dependent on outside sources for your operating money. But it is, I have no compunctions about applying for capital funds from outside sources. When we put up a building, we go write a grant and ask some grant-making body to help us acquire these new assets, which is like a foundation on which we're going to do the ministry that we want to do. The first one that I wrote was for a telephone system. $18,000 grant to buy a sophisticated, high-volume telephone system, because I work in a port. I'm a port chaplain, and the number one need of international seafarers, there are very few Americans working on the ships anymore. They're almost all from countries of the global south, Philippines, Honduras, Guatemala, Croatia, Russia, Italy, Portugal, all over the world, wherever people are desperate enough for dollars that they will leave their families a year at a time to support them. And as a result, these people who live and work on board the cargo ships and in our port, the cruise ships, we're in South Florida, their number one need is to make telephone calls. And when we arrived in our, when I arrived to start this work, I said, the first thing we ought to do is look at what are the needs of the people that we want to serve. What's their economy? The people that we want to be in ministry to, what do they spend their money on? And it didn't take much digging to figure out that they spend more money making long-distance phone calls than anything else. So we applied for a grant, a capital grant, to buy a telephone system for $18,000 and set up a pretty sophisticated way for them to come into our center and make telephone calls cheaper than any other means that was available to them. Now, I'm a big advocate for adopting the notion that when you want to do ministry, anybody you're serving, I don't care how poor they are, poor people spend money. Everybody spends money. Poor people spend money, and usually they pay more for whatever it is they spend their money on than anybody else does. And I'm an advocate that we ought not be shy about involving ourselves with the economy of the people that we want to serve. But I will tell you that it's a controversial view. The maritime ministry that we are developing in Fort Lauderdale's Port Everglades, is a new member of an old tradition. For 175 years, in ports all around the world, churches have been reaching out to take care of the needs of merchant seafarers, the people who live on ships. Originally, it started in England 175 years ago as a way of trying to clean up. You know, there was this big missionary movement in England, and somebody said, well, what are we sending missionaries to convert the natives in Africa for when we got some of the roughest, hardest living people you could imagine right there in our ports? And they need Christ too. God knows they need to change their life. I mean, seafarers traditionally have the reputation of being a pretty rough crowd. And so somebody decided that there should be a mission in the ports to take care of seafarers. And over the years, that idea of maritime ministry has grown and has evolved as the seafarers have. My dad, who's a retired Lutheran pastor, when he came and started volunteering with us, he was, in fact, every time he comes, he still comments on how surprised he is at what wonderful people these seafarers are. He said, I was expecting hard-drinking, rough-living kind of people. That's kind of the image he carries of who seafarers are. But he finds instead very gentle, pious, wonderful people. So we decided that now it's controversial among my sister chaplains. Most of whom have been around, their ministries, their agencies have been around for 100 years or more. And they have a secure source of funding in the local synod or diocesan budget. You know, there's a sacred line item in the budget which for decades has always paid for a chaplain in the port. And those chaplains have the idea that, you know, their money, they have this steady flow of funds. We didn't have that luxury. When we went into South Florida, there was a booming shipping industry, including tremendous cruise industry, tens of thousands of seafarers coming into our port, working on cruise ships, and nothing in the way of maritime ministry. And there wasn't a church denomination in sight that was willing to, or was able to start providing a new line item in its budget. In fact, in 1990 and throughout the 1990s, church budgets have been shrinking, not expanding. So it's become increasingly difficult to look to the church to provide new sources of funding for a new ministry. And that's why I think my, if controversial among some of my chaplain colleagues, is still nevertheless the right way to go, to say that we ought not be shy about involving ourselves with the economy of the people we want to serve for three reasons. Number one, they need the help. The people that the seafarers that we wanted to serve needed help making phone calls. I mean, you can't imagine when we started in that port how many people would struggle to buy $20 worth of quarters so that they could sit in a payphone in the middle of the night and feed. You know how many quarters you need to make a phone call to the Philippines? A lot. And they would sit there and feed all these quarters in. Would interrupt them just after they had started to greet their wife, you know, for the first time in a month maybe. The operator would come on the line and say, now put in another $5.75 worth of quarters. And that takes a long time to put in $5.75 worth of quarters. So they needed help making a phone call more efficiently. And what we offered them was a chance to come in and sit down at a phone booth and pick up the phone and dial, and then just talk as long as they wanted to talk. And when they hung up, we had a computer there that would tell us how long they talked and how much we should charge them for that. And it was cheaper than they would have paid at the payphone. And it was a heck of a lot more, it was without interruption, which is very important. If you only talk to your wife once every 6 weeks, it's important to be able to have a call that doesn't get interrupted. And thirdly, it was a lot more comfortable than standing in the rain at a payphone. So the first reason to get involved with that economy of the people you want to serve is to, because they need help. There are services that they buy that we can offer them better. Secondly, as soon as you involve yourself with somebody's economy, if you do it smart, there will always be a margin to help you cover some of your operating costs and the telephones by negotiating hard with AT&T and MCI and Sprint and playing them all off against each other and gradually increasing our volume. We have cut what we pay for an international minute of long distance by 75%. In other words, if we were paying a dollar when I started 5 years ago, we're paying 25 cents for that same minute now. And that's just by getting smarter at how we negotiate with them, having to learn an industry. And nobody ever taught me telecommunications in seminary. But it was the result of saying, you know, these are the people we want to serve. These are the needs that they have. By meeting those needs, we can establish a basis on which to grow our own infrastructure that will, thirdly, and this is maybe the most important, make us beholden to their interests rather than the interests or whims of a funder. If you are living off of the economy of the people you want to serve, then trust me, you need a relationship with a lot of them in order to keep the doors of your ministry open. If, on the other hand, you get your money by going to the annual church convention and making a moving speech about the one seafarer that you helped on a rainy night when he was desperate, you know, one or two anecdotes. You don't need more than one or two people a year to serve, really, to raise your money. And I'm, you know, being extreme and a little bit cynical to suggest that that goes on, but trust me, it does. There are people who do a great job of representing their ministry to the churches that fund it and are hard to find on the ground serving their clients. And there are others who who have a terrific relationship with their clients and may not be so well known at the church level. Now, the ideal, of course, is both. You should be serving lots of people, and you should be well known to the churches, because the churches need you as much as you need them. Let me give you some more examples. I talked a little bit about Seafarer's House. The telephones are a huge source of our operating income and are a huge reason why so many people come to us. In 5 years' time, it's not quite 5 years' time, we've gone from one employee, me, to over 20 now. We were open 3 days a week for about 20 hours total. We're now open every day of the year, at least 106 hours a week. And you work it out, that's an average of over 15 hours a day. And that's important in a port, because seafarers sail in and out all the time with the modern technology that unloads the containers from ships, or with the cruise industry where the ships come in the morning, they change passengers, and they go out again in the afternoon. The workers on board those ships are in port for a very narrow amount of time, very short period of time. And if we're not open when they need us, we can't serve them. So we had to be open for huge hours. But from a business point of view, that's a disaster. That's very difficult. And I'm proud that we've been able to accomplish it with very little in the way of church funding. We get, I figured out, we've gotten over 5 years about $50,000 from the Episcopal Church. And it's got to be in 5 years under $5,000 from all other churches combined. And if you figure that our budget is $1 million this year, you can see that a very tiny percentage of our funding has come actually from the churches who we say we represent. And in fact, we do represent, but not in a financial sponsorship way so much as in a morally representative way, or in a theological way. And it's not just the phones. We got involved in some other things, but I don't want to talk just about that ministry tonight, because I don't want anyone to walk away with the impression that if they wanted to start a maritime ministry, they now know how to do it, but not any other kind of ministry, because I really think that the principle applies across the board. And the better off economically the people you want to serve, the more ample are the opportunities to set that up. Let's think together of some other examples. And one of the first that should come to your mind are counseling centers. Churches have gotten into the business of doing counseling, as well we should. There are people, professional Christian therapists, who want to practice counseling from a self-consciously Christian perspective. And at least in Florida, I know there are churches that set up Christian counseling centers and say, we're going to, you know, in a very professional way, we're going to provide marriage counseling, we're going to provide substance abuse counseling. And those places usually run on a fee basis. And they generate a significant portion of their operating funds from their clients. Not all of it, and we don't either. You know, we depend on the port to do an annual golf and tennis tournament that raises $20,000 in one day. That helps us. But $20,000 out of $1 million, I mean, I'm not knocking it. It's important. And there are a few other things like that that happen. We need some charitable funds, but you could take away all of our charitable funding and we would cut back maybe 25% and stay in business. But how many charitable agencies do you know that could lose all of their charitable funding and not close down completely? And what influence does it have on you to chase the money and the interests of the people who give you that charitable funding? So counseling centers are another example. I promised you some examples from abroad. And in my experience the church in Africa, which is very exciting, and we'll say more about the forum tonight, and then I'm going to do a session just on Africa and some of the things happening in that lively church on Saturday evening. And I'd be curious if you, if this triggers anything for you as well. African churches, the best of them, in my opinion, have long ago learned that if they depended, to the degree they continue depending on grants from the churches of the North, namely Europe and the United States and Canada, they're not going to grow very fast, at least not at a rural grassroots level. Maybe the bishop looks to that grant to keep his office open, but not a heck of a lot of it ends up in some rural parish in Tanzania. So what those people have learned to do, now, these are strong Christians, and they are convicted by their call to discipleship. So they say, there's no reason for us to be the church here unless we are about the business of helping our people. And I could all night long cite instances of churches that, for example, buy grinding mills. That was a favorite grant of ours. In fact, one of the last grants that I recommended, and I'm haunted by not knowing what happened, was to an Anglican diocese in Rwanda. Rwanda is a tortured place, if you've read much of the news, and that's why I'm haunted. To set up grinding mills. African women do most of the work, certainly most of the agricultural work. And corn is a staple in their diet. And it's typical in most of Africa that women who harvest this corn, in order to prepare the daily food every day, have to sit there with a couple of stones and grind the corn into a meal with which to cook. An immensely time-consuming task that is also very unhealthy because that usually happens in a hut, and when you start grinding, you know, all this dust rises and you inhale it, and so it's both unhealthy and tremendously time-consuming and labor-intensive. Churches in many parts of Africa have learned that they can get a capital grant to buy the grinding mill and set it up in a rural situation and let people come and pay a few cents to grind their corn in 5 minutes electronically or with diesel fuel, or some of the grinding mills, the ones we bought in Mozambique, you ran by hand. Depends on the industrial infrastructure of the country and what's cost effective, what's going to work, what kinds of machinery can be repaired when it breaks. That was a big factor. But the principle was that the churches said, our people, the women who make up the backbone of the church, are spending tremendously long hours in an unhealthy atmosphere grinding corn. Why don't we offer them a service that they can pay for, which will generate money for the church, will give a job to the people who sit there running the grinding mills, will foster the community that happens when people gather and wait their turn in line to get their corn ground, will witness to the community at large that the church cares for the welfare of the people. It's not just preaching a pie-in-the-sky, life after death religion, but the church is about improving the welfare of people right here and now, and it generated income for the church. Animal husbandry projects are another one. There are countless churches in Africa that teach people to improve their nutrition by raising livestock. I know a group of monks, Anglican monks in Ghana, who raise pigs. Mostly because one of the brothers in this community just loves pigs. He loves pigs. And so he had the vision that pigs were good for the diet of the community. And he applied to Trinity when I was there for funds to set up a pig farming project. And what he needed was a little bit of construction money to build the place where he would raise his pigs, and then some high-quality stock to get started with. And then after that, it would generate itself. And because one of his vocations was to do prison ministry, He started working with prisoners on an out-release, day-release program who would come and help him run this pig farm. And then when they got released, he would give them a pig so that they could go home and get started with a pig farming project of their own. That program sustains the religious community of monks. It makes a great witness to the community of concern for the practical welfare of the people in that community. And it I'm starting to repeat myself here. Gardening projects are another one. You can imagine how that goes. In Richmond, Virginia, I saw a program where the church had a number of mentally challenged people in the congregation. People who, maybe some Down syndrome children who were somewhat capable of taking care of themselves, but not fully. And what they learned, they had a number of children in the congregation, and they realized that there were a lot more in the community. So what they did was get a government grant for the capital funding to build a home that would care for, that would allow these people who come and live in somewhat independent living situations. They found that there were a lot of people in their community, and Richmond is not a large town, who were a great burden to their family, living with their family, but who couldn't live 100% in an apartment in town all by themselves, but could go from the family life into this building where the whole building was populated by other people of similarly challenged, and they one resident manager could live there and look after people to some degree. And then out of this, the fact that they had all these people living in this building right next to the church developed a whole ministry of fellowship with this with these persons, where they would take them on outings and give them activities to do, and where they became a witness to the congregation as well about the way in which God and the Holy Spirit can speak to us through the diversity of human nature. We're not all equally abled, and thank God we're not, because it's from our diversity that we start to see things from different points of view. Now, the families were happy to pay rent for their troublesome child to live in this kind of a facility, so that the operating money of the facility could be sustained from the rents paid by the occupants. The capital funding came from government money, and the church had undertook a great new ministry. All of these examples, and the ones I want to hear from you as well, reflect, I believe, a principle. The first principle that I learned when I started working as a grant maker, and my boss sat me down and he said, "Now, the first thing you got to understand is money doesn't make things happen. Leadership does. And the people who have money to give away and are smart about how they do it know that you can pour any amount of money down a bottomless pit and nothing is guaranteed to happen unless you've invested that money where there's really good leadership." And I think we've got to take seriously our baptism that says we're equipped to be disciples, and God will be walking alongside of us to see that the help we need will be there when we look for it. Evidence my case of studying and learning telecommunications industry, which I never trained for, because I like to learn new things, but also because I was convinced that this was a need of the people that I wanted to serve, and that if we addressed ourselves faithfully to that need, we'd find ways of meeting it. Now, I haven't been paying any attention to the time here. Okay, we're in pretty good shape. I would like to hear of other examples that you know of that reflect this principle of involving ourselves with the economy of the people we want to serve for their benefit and for sources of operating funds.
Your concepts and your ideas are just unquestionably wonderful. And the first time we've heard somebody say, involve people with the ones that we're dealing with. I would like to really ask heavier observations on this question. We're not alternatives, and yet many of us are facing, whether we be downtown urban situations or whether we be parishes where suddenly there is this influx of money now in terms of foundations and grants and donations.
Mm-hmm.
And so often the ownership of that money, people, you've made some extremely good ideas between capital and operating. Mm-hmm. But so often we are faced with an almost obsession to get these things into operating funds.
Yeah. Big mistake.
But how do we move our people? You know, I wish I could all hear this lecture you've given in terms of that, but
I think what
to move them from the capital, which I'm sure you face in a downtown parish, which is a once for all, but get that sense of how do we get our grants? And you know, our grants usually run not in millions, but in terms of thousands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
4,000, 5,000, 10,000. How do you apply that principle on a much smaller basis? Maybe I'm naive.
No.
Well, how do you get people to understand it, and then how do you begin to develop that with a parish at a local level?
That's why I took the trouble at first to start by looking at some of the philanthropies. And I think you could do the same thing in your parish. You just write to the foundations, the big ones, and ask them for their annual report or their funding guidelines. And the first thing you'll find is that they're very focused. And then help your people understand that the people who got big bucks know that even big bucks isn't enough to serve their needs. And so by discipline do is get very focused on what they think they can do. And I think anybody who, you know, whether I'm not sure if you're talking about endowments now, or you're talking about a couple of thousand that come off of the interest of your endowment, or you're talking about a grant that you get from United Way to do something?
Talking both ways, but basically at this point I'm talking local parish, a few thousand dollars, $20,000 to $50,000 that come off of endowments.
Okay. I think I would be a very strong advocate there that you need to do some long-range planning, some strategic planning, and I'll bet you've got people in your congregation who from the private sector are familiar with the whole concept of strategic long-range planning and will help you do it. It isn't something you do overnight. You take your church council or your vestry or whatever you call it in your congregation, and you do some retreats and you do some long-range. Maria's parish just did this. They went on one or two retreats off campus for a while. They developed a parish mission statement. It's an Episcopal parish. The priest preached on that mission statement one day, had the whole congregation sign it after it had been in the bulletin for a couple of weeks. And it's a 10-year plan for what they're going to do. And they've got an endowment, but now they've also got a 10-year plan in place about which a lot of thinking and planning has gone. And so every time the winds blow one way and some people in the church say, well, we got that $20,000, you know, we could spend it, we can buy it, we can do it with that. You say, wait a minute, what's in our plan? Is this according to the principles that we've all agreed to for how we're going to spend that money?
Basic tension is operating versus benevolence.
Say more about what you mean there.
Basic tension is we want to put a roof on a place, we want to build, you know.
Right. Are we going to put a new organ in, or are we going to give the money to some social outreach program that we believe in? And I think, well, the parish plan that I was so impressed with in her parish has a little bit of both. But it's very clear. We're going to do both, you know. And therefore, this year, if we're going to put a new roof on, what's going to be the balance to that? Or maybe if we've got a roof coming that we know we can see, we ought to start setting money aside so that we say that our capital monies each year, you know, that every year we're going to reinvest in ourselves. And I think that's another way that really the parish leadership, the pastor, has to learn to help people see that, that you know, help us draw the line between what is investment in ourselves and what is reaching out for others. And, you know, you can say a new roof will serve all those people who are going to come and visit us on Sunday mornings. But basically, the capital versus operating is helpful there, because you don't need too many accountants in your group to tell you that investment in a new roof is a capital asset that on your books doesn't go down as an expense, it goes down as a fixed asset, you know, and then you start to depreciate it, and that's how it goes away.
I don't want to preoccupy.
No, that's a good, and I think relevant to numbers. The danger is, and the whole, what happened in her parish was that they started eating up their endowment on just basic operating things, because the parish contributions fall off, and it's guaranteed that they will fall off if you have an endowment. That's why there are a lot of people say that endowments are not a healthy thing for the stewardship of the congregation. And even at a Trinity, you know, the rector there preaches hard on the subject of stewardship. Says, you know, you need to give not because we need it, but because it's good to give. God challenges you to give because you need the experience of giving. Are there other questions or things you've seen along these lines that you can
share? I have more of a question. I was wondering if you could give more perspective on why foundations and so many organizations prefer to give startup funds all the time. I come from a perspective that I lived a long time in one area of Africa and saw several groups come and go basically during that time. Dump something off, they had this idea for a project, start something. Give a windmill or a something and leave, and that would soon die out, and somebody else would come along with something. So I have a concern that all the groups thinking that startup funds is the answer, and then the continued operation will sort of take care of itself. Maybe you covered that when you said leadership is the most important thing. How do we know if leadership is there?
Yeah,
when you give startup funds,
that's there is probably more reporting that you can make a report that sounds good, saying you put a small amount of money getting something kicked off, and hopefully you can get out before the thing fails and nobody knows that happened.
This is my concern. Yeah. And as you raised it, that you were involved in a benevolence project, philanthropy that urged startup projects.
I used to adopt the principle of saying I'm looking for people with an idea that I'm convinced by them they are going to do with or without my help. And that with...
Well, that's different than a lot today.
With our help, they will do it quicker and better. But that, if the leadership is so strong there, there are some people you meet with a vision, you just know that they're one way or another, they're going to put that, that's going to happen. And then you say, okay, this isn't dependent on me. I think there are good and bad reasons why foundations limit themselves to startup. The bad thing is that they don't really want to be too involved. I mean, it's the same. They don't want to be too involved because they don't want the grantee to become dependent on them. And they want to move on and do other things. And the better foundations now have said, like Ford, says, if we start working with you, we're there for at least 10 years.
Right.
Because we think it may take that long to provide the kind of institutional development that will make a difference. Kellogg's, their whole thing is they invest in leadership training and leadership development. And they really don't do nearly as much in terms of funding projects. But they do a tremendous amount in terms of finding promising people and giving them the opportunity for further study or networking them. You know, there's been a whole evolving idea that instead of taking people from Africa to study in a U.S. university, where the whole environment and the context for research and everything else is completely different from what they've got back home, and then send them back home and expect them to be trained, it's much better to take, for the same price, three or four people from one part of Africa and send them to another part of Africa where they've done a They've had great insight. Let me translate that. I once made a recommendation to a church-based funding program in this country that instead of making little startup grants of, I think it was a couple of $1,000 each, maybe $3,000-$4,000 each, to congregations that wanted to start congregationally based ministries, and they tended to be feeding programs or homeless shelters or halfway houses for people coming off of drug rehabilitation programs, that kind of thing. Instead of giving lots of different congregations a few $1,000s to start such a program, that money wasn't significant enough to really make the difference to help these ministries get off the ground in a sustainable way. That organization was much better off to invest those funds in travel grants. And to say to a congregation in Milwaukee that wants to start a halfway house, we will help you, a group of you, not one, because if you just expose one or two people, that's not enough. If you got to have a critical mass. If you get three or four or five people from a congregation who go and visit two other churches that have done a terrific job of setting up halfway houses and have learned a lot about what to do and what not to do, then instead of letting that congregation in Milwaukee reinvent the wheel and probably make the same mistakes that everybody else makes, you can jumpstart the mistakes leapfrog the mistakes by letting them see what else happens. It's that concept of exchange that I think is a much more potent bang for your buck than simply investing it in the same old rent for 6 months in a shelter, which then 6 months later doesn't have the rent anymore and has to close, or makes other mistakes along the way that could have been avoided because other people have already learned those mistakes, but we didn't talk to them when we started it up. So I think the funders, to get back to your question, they don't want the continuing involvement because they don't want the dependency because they want new projects. We have a board meeting three times a year. And at every one of those board meetings, our bosses expected us to come up with exciting new programs in new places. What they did not want to hear was that the project we started up now needs another 3 years of... Because then they say, pretty soon, all of our money is just going to go to sustaining the same group of 100 projects that we started.
Yeah, but new people keep coming into the port. I mean, I don't see why new is better.
Uh-huh. But I'm not advocating for it. I'm trying to explain it. I had my own frustrations with it. And I think that particularly funders who, and this is most of them, who say, we're looking for 2 or 3 year startup projects. I'm pretty cynical about that. It's not 2 or 3 years is not enough to really get much started. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, then so what they may say, we're not really in the business of creating new institutions. We just want to add a cute little program to an existing institution because if the institution's already there, then it's strong enough to sustain itself. But hey, we need some new institutions too. And who's going to help us do that? Challenge me with some of the ministries you'd like to start that you're not sure how to... maybe within the resources of the room, we've got enough creativity, we can offer you some ideas. I've had some people say to me, seafarers, they have jobs, so they have an income, $250 a month, but... Hey, that's an income. But I think even homeless, jobless people, they spend money on something. And we ought to be able to help them spend it better. And as soon as we do that, there's going to be a margin to help support us. All right, as you can see, I got a lot of feelings for this, and I'm grateful that there were a few people who let me share it tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
I also brought along as proof for what we've been talking about some copies of our 95 annual report, because that's the best source of data and graphs about how this principle has worked in one place with a lot of hard work by Maria and myself. These sessions are, all of our sessions are advertised as being by both David and Maria, and it just depends on which session, which one of us you get, or combination thereof. So yesterday and today has been me. The next 2 days will be the two of us. Next week she'll do one on her own. Thank you for coming. Take an annual report if you're curious.